And you're all set.
Good morning, guys. My name is JP. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much, Jim, for inviting me. John, you're absolutely in my prayers. You're in my prayers every day. And welcome to the newcomers. Anybody who's the first time here or just coming back, it's great to have everybody. So, my story is not unlike so many other stories. Today is another really beautiful day in a life that I really didn't quite anticipate being as good and as well as it was going to be. It seemed fated to my stars when I got my first bit of taste of alcohol that it was going to be a problem. I was five, and my uncle had come to visit, and he was, they were sitting there, and he let me drink a good portion of his brandy. And then that night, of course, a little later, we had had liver for dinner, which I, oh, so disgusting. But I got sick because I'd had so much brandy, but they thought it was the liver, of course, because what bad could that possibly happen from alcohol? But it really was just kind of a foreshadowing of what was to come. So by the time I was 13, there were no two of us six siblings living together. We had all been cast to the winds in various places, either kicked out of the home, in foster care. My mother, who is a very, very aggressive, and she was definitely one of us. She ended her life as an AA, although she did not engage in the steps as we understand the steps. But she was participating, from what I understand, to the degree she could at the end of her life. But as I grew older, as I grew into my older years of 10, 13, 14, I was struggling with already many of the addictive behaviors that so many of us are familiar with. It began like silly, like so many kids, sniffing glue, stealing mom's cigarettes, trying to find any way we could. But alcohol started to play more and more of a role as I got older, and my first real real sickness from alcohol, and that I definitely remember. I was at this friend of the family's home, and he got me so drunk, and I know I passed out, and I don't know when I woke up, but I woke up covered in my own vomit, and I was naked, and I didn't know what had happened, but I was pretty sure I'd been sexually assaulted. And that was for me, that was a bit of, I'd stopped drinking after that for a while. Shortly after that, I ended up in foster care and ended up in the system in Canada. And I occasionally would dabble with whatever I could to change and alter my state thereafter. But it wasn't until college, really, after years of kind of going from group home to group home, and a couple other really uncomfortable, like, traumatic things happening in there, that I decided at when I left the group home system and I had been transferred from Canada over to the United States, I struggled all my years of high school, and really finally just kind of made it out of high school at the end and started college. And it was then that I got reintroduced to drinking. It was a very normalized kind of thing in the culture, and it was like almost expected that you would drink. And at first it was just a dabble here, dabble there, but it wasn't within a year or so I was, blackout drinking on the weekends. And weekends went from Thursday to Sunday night, and then they became almost every night, towards the end of my initial college career. I was Because I was in the foster care system, when I was living at a group home after I got to college, when I left, essentially I was homeless. So I lived on the dorms, and I didn't really have any kind of strong contact. So I was just kind of on my own from that point on. And my drinking was still, mostly just kind of that, with friends kind of stuff. I dabbled with other kinds of dry goods and various herbs and things, but Really, still, alcohol was my primary thing that I was doing. Like so many other people, I did, entry level jobs. I did not finish my college career. I just could not afford to work a full-time job and do full-time school. And so I washed out after a couple of attempts to finish it up, but never did. And then, so I worked, and then I got a labor job doing, construction work. And I met this woman who, we met at a bar. And initially we were kind of parties together. It was good. It was, but they definitely made it clear to me that my drinking was not exactly like their drinking. Many of my friends were big people, just taller, bigger, larger people. They would drink, and yes, they would get drunk, but I would get a different level of drunk. And I would oftentimes, when I if I had the money to drink, I would drink to the point where I would be sick for days after. And that went on for a couple of years there, and then my girlfriend and I decided we were going to get married, and we immediately had a kid after that. And something changed when I had my son, my first son in 2003. And I don't know what it was, but one thing that did definitely change was my wife told me that I couldn't drink around the baby at all, period. That it was not okay for me to drink in company because of my previous behaviors, and she knew what kind of drinker I was. Okay, so fine. So I just wasn't going to drink in the house. Well, what I did was I drank in the basement, and that started a real downward spiral on how my drinking was, because then I had to hide it and lie about it. And for all those years, I would just, sneak it in, drink it as fast and as hard as I could, and, hide it as best I could. And there were a few occasions where it was obvious that, things were known, but we weren't talking about it. And then this thing happened. So, my mother, who had, been an active alcoholic all of her life and had had many kind of runs at the goal line there, and kind of like made a big deal about it, from time to time. It would seem to be the only time we ever heard from mother after I had, moved into foster care was when she was dying. And I had happened to be visiting my brother in Canada on a weekend, and there was no reason for us to be visiting mother other than, he had said he was going to drop something off at her place, and he said, "Hey, I'm going over to mom's. You want to see her?" And like, well, no, I don't know. So I went, and she looked like death. She was yellow and gaunt and drawn, and not she barely looked like herself anymore. And the only thing she really wanted to do was kind of smoke her cigarettes and, just kind of be left alone kind of thing. But we visited, and I wasn't there but 5 minutes, and she was like, she's tired. So she went to go lay down, but as she was going to go lay down, she said to me, she said, she said, are you happy? You're happy with your life?" And I lied to her, and I knew I was lying to her because I was struggling. I was struggling my family and my relationship. I was sick in my body. I was drinking so much, and I was having real kind of just life problems that you have. But I lied to her, and I said, "Yeah, things are great," and we left, and then we got a call like 5 minutes, 10 minutes later. We went from her, from where she lived, over to my sister's place, who was just a few blocks away, and she had died. She had passed right there, and that night I went and I drank. I know I went and I got really drunk that night, but the fix was in, that I did. I suddenly kind of saw my own end and my mother, and a couple years later, still drinking, still sick, but I went to a doctor, and I said, "Geez, I'm just sick, and I don't feel good, and this isn't good." And so they gave me some medicine, they gave me I forget which particular drug they gave me to try to help me kind of, but I wasn't owning up to the full level of my drinking, and I tried to quit. Of course, I was drinking a few weeks later, and I expressed to my wife at the time that, this was going on, and she was like, "Well, you're going to quit or you're out. We're not going to do this." And so I just did my best to hide it as best I could more. And it wasn't but a few weeks later, there it was again. I was really sick again. So I went back to my doctor and he suggested, oh, okay, so I know this guy who's doing recovery work with people, because I didn't want to go to AA because, you know, I thought I knew what AA was. You know, I'd studied about it in school and, you know, I knew the statistics that, you know, so many white men get, you know, the idea of AA and so many people don't. And, you know, I know. So I was I'd been a counselor and I'd taken people to AA meetings, but I'd never, you know, I was not interested in the whole brotherhood and God thing. I was just was not, that's not what I wanted. I just wanted to not be sick and not feel like I felt. So when he suggested that I go to this recovery place with this guy that was treating black tar heroin addicts, I was like, you know, I was sick enough to say, yeah. So that's where I started going initially. I sat in a group with a couple of, with a bunch of people that were doing, you know, heroin and other kinds of drugs, and they were all on Suboxone, and they were on Suboxone and they were fine. But, you know, when I first met this doctor, I was drinking, I drank that night before, and he kind of did a quick assessment with me and he said, okay, so listen, don't stop drinking right away. You need to just, we're going to taper you down. We're going to give you a couple of, you're just going to take this, but we're going to plan on a few days and then you're going to quit, you know? So, and I followed his directions and then I did stop drinking and I called him every day and I went to this meeting with these other people and, I stopped drinking, but I was like white knuckling it through those first, you know, few weeks and months. And they were all fine. You know, they were, these people I was having these meetings with were, they were all taking the box off. So they were like, oh man, you don't look good. And, you know, they felt bad for me, you know, going through withdrawals. But I had, you know, met somebody there that was involved in the rooms. And some of you guys know Charmaine. And Charmaine was one of the people in my early recovery who kind of encouraged me gently to try and listen. You know, what have I got to lose if I go to a meeting and hear something that helps? And so I decided, I went to my first AA meeting where I walked in the door by myself over on Elmwood Avenue and kind of, you know, a few blocks from my house at the time. And I walked in the door and who did I see? My drinking buddy was right there, a guy I'd been drinking with. I hadn't seen him in a few years. And sure enough, of course, so, and I didn't really want to see him because, you know, drinking buddies, we weren't all that good of buddies. We were just, you know, kind of drinking friends. But I did start hearing things in those meetings and I did start to get it. But I held out as long as I could. I was sick and I was really anti the whole, like, you know, God thing. One part of my story about religion is the way I was taught religion. So with my mother as a child, religion was more like a morality beating instead of, you know, some loving God. She would, you know, she would yell at us from the front seat of the car while she was driving, you know, Jesus was teaching in the synagogue at 12, but you can't remember your hockey stick. I had to be, everything was, you know, this kind of mean spirited thing. And she liked to do church from her Barca lounger in the morning, you know, on Sunday morning with Jimmy Swaggart and all those guys. And she just, you know, with a beer in her hand. So like the idea of religion, when I started to kind of understand religion more from a perspective of need, was, you know, somewhat distorted and bent, more Monty Python-ish than, you know, actual understanding of what it means to have a spiritual thing in your life. And it took me a long time to walk back from those cynical beliefs and feelings around religion to let go enough to hear the message of what was Alcoholics Anonymous and what I've come to rely on. So when I first started with AA, when I heard in the meetings, and you know, I was a double winner too. So I was sick enough early on, they suggested AA, but somebody also suggested, hey, you know, you might try Al-Anon too. That's, you know, because clearly you've got some bent up needs around your mom and your, you know, family. And I did. I found a seat at an Al-Anon table and I met my sponsor, my first sponsor, Dave, who did first walk through with the steps for me. But he was, you know, a double winner too, both sitting in both meetings, and we would go to meetings together. And he was I distinctly remember saying to him, I do not have this higher power thing in my life. I do not welcome it. I don't know what it is or how to even begin. Like, you know, I had been forced to get, you know, confirmed in a church by my aunt and uncle as a result of, as a, you know, they said, you cannot live in our house unless you go to, you know, church and you get confirmed. So it was like a have to thing. And I never wanted it. And he said, well, you know, I told him I don't have this. And he said, well, you know, mine has been good. You can borrow mine until you're ready to have one of your own. And that was enough, you know, for me to it was disarming enough. Like, okay, I can just borrow an idea for now. I don't have to, you know, I had to really practice setting aside what I thought God was. I had to set aside what I thought religion was. I had to set aside all of the fights and arguments and beliefs that I had just to sit, just to start. You know, because he said, you know, if you do what we do here, you'll get what we get here. It's very simple. It's not complicated or difficult. Just if you're willing to try, you will find that this works. And yeah, I could see people at the meetings. They were getting well. And this guy that was sitting in front of me had had a harrowing childhood, not unlike mine. And he was happy. And he seemed calm and centered in himself. And I was able to kind of connect with that idea that, you know, you can get better. This can happen. And it is a series of actions and choices that we make. So my wife at the time, who had told me that she was going to leave me because of my drinking, was also very against AA as well. She felt like this was cultish and that it was, you know, she did not want me standing outside of churches, those people smoking, looking like a homeless person. She was like, you're not, you know, this is, so her idea was also steeped in somewhat, you know, the stereotype that is somewhat negative around AA. And I, of course, shared that to a degree. So it took me a little bit to kind of recognize the value of what I was planning to do and how it was going to help. But my sponsor was, again, just like, this is just action. These are things of willingness. You just have to try it. And he suggested to me that I get down on my knees in the morning and I do my readings. And, you know, throughout the day, I try and pray. And at the end of the day, I say thank you. And I, you know, and initially those early meetings where I talked to him every day and I had to get to a meeting, you know, as often as I could. I couldn't go every day. I still work and I still had this whole family life thing going on. I didn't lose everything. I didn't get the DWIs, not for lack of trying though, you know? And, he said, you just have to try and do this and you'll get some. So my first experience with trying to connect with my higher power began in my kitchen. I had a west side of Buffalo. I had a little apartment with my wife and my kids, and we had one of those postage stamp kitchens. It was, you know, just enough room for the refrigerator, the stove, the sink, and there was a small table, and just enough to, you know, for two people to sit in that kitchen. So it was far enough away from the morning activities that I could get up and go and try to do my, get down on my knees and pray every morning. And there were many times where I would be in the kitchen, kneeled in front of the stove, this old Electrolux stove, and I'd be looking like I was praying to the stove. My wife would walk in the room behind me and she'd, you know, make a disgusted noise and turn around and walk away. And I was like, just those initial kinds of like just doing were somewhat uncomfortable. They felt uncomfortable, but the more I did it, the more connected I felt, the more I began to just kind of understand why I was doing what I was doing and what it was actually doing for me. I needed to subjugate my will. I needed to get on my knees, to do this thing, to put myself in a position of powerlessness, because I really thought I knew what I was doing, but I had to start to be a little bit more humble about what I was actually doing. All of my best thoughts, all of my best ways of thinking about things again and again led me down into my basement to drink myself into oblivion for years. So this simple act of just trying to do this prayer in the morning thing was challenging, but simple, it was powerful, and it helped me kind of change my humility, my belief about my own humility and what that meant for me. And gradually over time, I developed this relationship with a higher power that I still don't understand. I don't have a name for. I don't feel the need to do so. All I know is that as I've done these things, these simple things where I've, you know, turn it over, right? Let go and let God. I know that's one of those big things from Al-Anon, but also here in our rooms, is that process of, you know, these I have no power and I've never had power, and just give my life and my will over. Stop, and I have these problems that are bigger than me, and I can't fix them, and all my best efforts fail. So turning that over was, you know, one of those first things that I learned on my knees there. It took me a while to get through the steps, to get through my four-step inventory. It took me about a little more than a year or so. And I was putting effort into it. I was not trying to not do it, but it was a long and challenging kind of thing. And as I progressed through the steps, I definitely saw each one of those promises with each one of those steps coming true. And I remember doing my ninth step with my wife. And when I finished, and I thought I'd done such a good job, she said, "Okay, now you sit down. Now, you know, just let me tell you how it really was, because you weren't really there for a lot of it." And then she dressed me down, woke me up, made me realize, you know, that my perception of what had happened was not really all that accurate either. And my recollections needed a little bit of work. I've missed out on a good portion of my daughter's birth and life and early life because, you know, particularly as those waning years of my drinking, you know, I drank more and more and more. I was much more difficult to live with, which is why she was going to kick me out. But from that, we were able to recover. And things did start to get better. And although she didn't really like the idea of me being an alcoholic, she definitely saw the change in my behavior, the way I was living, and what it was meaning in our relationship. After 2 years of sobriety, it seemed like things were really good. We had some really good days. And I remember this perfect day. We got up, we made kids breakfast. We had a good day at work. We had come home. We, you know, had dinner together and we played up front. And we were living that dream life that I had wanted for us. And that night, my wife and I, we made love, and it was so wonderful. And then she started coughing. And within 20 minutes, she was gone. She had a massive heart attack at 40 years old. In that 2 years of recovery, life had just changed so much. And, you know, even for Christmas, you know, that somebody had given us a bottle of wine, you know, not knowing that I was in recovery. And that wine was up on the, you know, top of the refrigerator. And I started calling down my list, and people came to my house, and they took that wine and they helped me. Excuse me. A wall of human protection, you know, just wrapped around me. And those first couple of years were really hard. And I was very connected. And people came and helped, and, you know, it was wonderful. You know, and I didn't drink. And in those years after, you know, I was active in conference. I was still participating, member of, you know, so many different groups, and I really felt the power of what this program is. and life continued to happen and things began to change. But unfortunately, my two children, they struggled. And one developed a pretty severe mental illness. He had been autistic, and we'd never gotten him diagnosed until much later, but he had been challenging, and him and his mom were, she was such a strong motivator and just the light in the life for this boy. And when she left, he struggled, and I was not mom. And his autism really took off, and he had a break there, and he ended up going through a whole series of really hard things. Our family struggled with him, went through this thing. And then my daughter also developed pretty severe depression and ended up also going through the whole mental health, you know, in and out of CPAP thing. So I had two kids doing this mental health stuff and just struggling in teenage years and COVID. And then COVID. And I had still been an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was, you know, still had a sponsor. I was active. I was talking to people, but I can't tell you what led me to go and just think that I had the ability to drink again, but I did. I don't know why or how that actually happened, that it was okay in my head. I had seen so many people come and go. Program knew that I was still an alcoholic. But really, I had kind of started to take a little bit of, you know, grander pride in myself. In those years when, you know, my wife had passed, I'd gone to school and I'd, you know, gotten a degree and I'd gotten a new job and I'd really kind of, you know, had to step up and move up and be stronger and do more, and, you know, have to, you know, went from I felt like I was doing, and I took back my will. I took it back, and I don't know if I thought I was in a place I could drink, but I can tell you, right after that first drink, I knew that I was going to have to lie about it. I couldn't face you. I couldn't face my girlfriend or my kids. Time, I just, you know, I had a couple of weeks of drinking, and I was like getting sick again. I was like immediately right back to the kind of drinking I had been doing before, and I was feeling sick in my body again. And I told them myself, you know, and again, you know, the wall of human, you know, protection closed in around me. My home group cared for me, and people, you know, came to my aid, and my sponsor stepped up, and my wife was like, no, we're going to beat this thing. And just a few weeks later, I drank again. And I, again, and then it was just 2 years of just fumbling from one relapse to the next. I have a stack of coins, you know, 1 month, 1 month, 3 months, 1 month, 3 months. I did not know myself. I did not understand what was going on or what my motivation was or why I was continuing to do it. I just was doing it. And it made no sense to me for a long time. I was really starting to think that I had just completely gone crazy, because I could not understand why I was still drinking. But it wasn't all that hard. I had decided that I could do this, that I was, you know, doing this, that I was the one getting sober. And it never was. It was never me. And all I needed to do was get back to what I had done in the first place. And that was get on my knees and beg for help from this thing that I'm powerless against, and just wait and listen. That's the hard part, isn't it? The waiting to just have it let go. But it did. As soon as I genuinely turned my will and my life back over to the care of my understanding, to the God of my understanding, I got it. I got it again. And since then, I have again re-experienced all the steps that come from that nine step promises. You know, today I'm again active in my home group. I'm here. I'm present every day. I'm able to recognize that my higher power is doing for me all those things that I cannot do. And there are many things that I cannot do. And I know better than to try. And so long as I allow myself the humility of recognizing that I am not in control of it, I have a higher power just for that reason. So that is my share. And with that, gentlemen, thank you for letting me share.